Welcome to Profiles. I'm David Brent Johnson, and for the next hour, we'll be talking with ethnomusicologist and Indiana University professor Portia Maltsby. Professor Maltsby is the director of the Archives of African American Music and Culture at Indiana University, and also the director of the Ethnomusicology Institute and Program at Indiana University as well. Her work has appeared in numerous journals, and she's been a consultant to the historical documentary series Eyes on the Prize 2 and Black Radio, Telling It Like It Was. In addition, Ms. Maltsby is a keyboard player and the founding director of the IU Soul Review, a touring ensemble that specializes in the performance of African-American popular music, and she's also the co-editor of the new anthology African-American Music, An Introduction. Professor Maltsby, welcome to Profiles.
Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. You obviously lead a busy life, judging from that introduction, and you wear many hats. You're an ethnomusicologist, and you're somebody who's deeply steeped in the history and the scholarship of the music that you study, but you're also a performer, and I was wondering if you could talk about your early experiences with both playing and listening to music.
I grew up in Orlando, Florida, in a household where music was greatly appreciated, all styles of music. I had a brother who, at least I have a brother, who is 15 years older than I am, and he was very much involved in learning about all kinds of music, all styles. We had recordings of classical music, jazz, R&B of the time, and I was exposed to this music. I think it's as a younger person in the household, we have the advantage of the knowledge and the preferences of our older siblings and even parents. As a result of hearing music daily, my brother noticed that I would climb up on the stool of the piano and pick out some of the melodies that I'd heard. And he approached my mother and said, I think we need to consider piano lessons for Portia. And he explained why. And my mother sought the counsel of the most recognized piano teacher in Orlando. And in fact, her aspirations was to have been a concert pianist. She was that good, but instead married and had a family and settled in Orlando. And she auditioned me and told mother that she certainly did think I should begin immediately with piano lessons. And that's when it began for me at age 5. So I started studying formally, even though I could play by ear. As I grew up and around age, I think I was around 8 or 9 years old, one of my our neighbors approached mother and said, we need a piano player for the children's Sunday school and church. And so she said, I would like for Portia, do you mind? And mother says, no, that's okay. And I remember going to her house and she sat down at the piano and she played something and she says, okay, this is what I want you to do. And that's when my real formal ear training began, and it began with the African American, you know, gospel tradition. So I grew up engaged in the performance of both African American and Western classical forms. And when I was in junior high school, I formed a little doo-wop vocal group, female vocal group. And I originally sang some parts, but I really was a keyboard player. And eventually I played piano, but I began as one of the singers. And that followed through my studies in Kansas at my undergraduate institution. And there I formed a band called Peaches and Cream. And we were very popular. We played in talent shows and proms and fraternity houses and clubs in this is in Kansas, so we traveled throughout the state and even in Nebraska. And my interests and experiences in the popular tradition continued in graduate school, where I formed another band and called Portia and the Soul Syndicate. And this is at the University of Wisconsin. And we were very popular, played the fraternity circuit. I remember we would play a beer party at 7 o'clock and then pack up, move to another fraternity and play a regular social event until 1 or 2 in the morning.
So you've had quite a background just as a musical performer, just out there kind of in the streets and the clubs and the churches, playing music. How did this performance aspect of your life end up influencing your work now as a professor and a researcher and a scholar and an author?
Well, I think my performing experiences in a variety of musical styles gave me a unique insight into the aesthetics of the tradition, programming the music, understanding audiences, their responses, their expectations. I have an insider's, if you want to put it in that way. I have an insider's view about the music, the process of the making of the music, and then the process for presenting the music and being aware of the reception of the music. And also, I must admit that my engagement in music, represents, I think, a balance between the African-American and the Western European. And largely because of my former studies, I was a piano major, as an undergraduate in school, and at the same time continuing my other studies and using the theory courses that I took or the knowledge that I gained from the theory courses that I took into understanding and writing and arranging popular music and, for performance. And so I think I have a very unusual insight in both traditions that I can bring to the level of a intellectual critique.
Well, this is a really broad question, but you've written quite a lot and worked quite a lot in the field, particularly of African American music. And what roles has music played in African American life?
Music is part and parcel of everything African Americans do. We wake up to music on the radio. Music is in the church. Music is a part of our social life. As children, it's a part of our play game, children's game songs. And it was always present in the community. And I think it's a force through which we express our views. We express the depth of our thoughts and our feelings and emotions. I think music is just part and parcel of life in the African-American community, and it's certainly connected with all forms of movement. Movement and music, they're all a part of the same process. There's no music without movement. There's no movement without music, even if we're making the music ourselves, a cappella, clapping, foot stomping, moving, whatever. It's just there. It's a part of who we are. It's a part of the African-American cultural identity.
What are some of the distinguishing aspects and values of African-American music? Say, what distinguishes it from European music as we think of it?
One is the function that in everyday life. The other, in terms of musical traits, rhythm is at the forefront of the aesthetic. And the reason being in that it is connected with movement. The music itself. So if it's a music that is a part of dance or it supports dance and movement, then rhythm is going to surface as the primary element, with melody and harmony being a part but ranking in a lesser order.
Did you start out studying African American religious and sacred music?
Formally, yes, I did. My studies as a graduate student focused on the music of the antebellum, or the period of slavery. Most of the scholarship focuses on religious music, and I think primarily because the researchers of the time expected slaves to do away with their secular traditions, and therefore slaves performed or sang the kinds of songs they thought that was expected of them. And there was also a thinking among the scholars or observers of the time that slaves did not participate in secular activities, mainly because of the religious influence, whereas outside of the public, slaves did as they pleased, which was to engage in both secular and sacred activities, blending the worlds as opposed to separating them along lines of the under the guise of Christianity.
Well, how and when did the boundaries between sacred and secular music begin to blur again in African-American music later on in the 20th century, in the mid-20th century, I guess, is the era that I'm thinking of?
The blurring of the secular traditions always existed from the early period of slavery through the 21st century, actually, today. But during the mid-20th century, the blurring became obvious to the general populace because of largely through the civil rights movement, where many of the songs that fed the movement originated in the church, and the church, the black church, became home for the movement. So songs moved out of the church into the streets, a different kind of lyric. And then from that movement, another kind of religious music evolved, and with a great deal of intensity. And that carried over into the secular world. During the era of the 1960s, for example, there was very little distinction between popular music that became known as soul music and gospel music. Soul music is rooted in the gospel tradition. And that, I think, brought to the surface the relationship between the sacred and the secular genres.
You've done an awful lot of research and work on how all of these sort of tributaries of African-American music have fed both American music in general and American culture in general. And I think one of the things that you hear the most often, you being anybody who's a fan of music or somebody who's interested in American musical history, is that rock and roll grew out of the black rhythm and blues of the late 1940s and the 1950s. How is that true? And can you point to a specific musical instance where we kind of hear this?
Yes. I think it's important to recognize that the term rhythm and blues was used to market all styles of African-American music, regardless of genre, beginning in the 1940s. Soon afterwards, the label became associated with a particular musical style, one that was blues-centered and, as one critic said, with rhythm. So blues, rhythm and blues essentially meant blues with rhythm. The rhythm and blues traditions has its origins in the music of the former big band and blues performers. They came together to create combos with the music being labeled rhythm and blues. The post-World War II generation created their own style of rhythm and blues. The earlier style reflected roots from jazz and roots from blues. The second generation, their music reflected more roots from the gospel tradition and their own innovations. So Little Richard, for example, I think is the pivotal point here, the figure, in making the transition between what we knew as the earlier forms of rhythm and blues into the second generational styles of rhythm and blues. For example, Little Richard wanted to create a music that had more energy, more reflective of a new spirit, a new times, a new generation. And he took his drummer, Charles Connor, to Macon, Georgia, and said, "Listen, you know, I want you to hear this train and the choo-choo-choo-choo beat." So he heard the train, and he says, "I want to replace the shuffle beat, the ching-ching-ching-ching, with ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch- Richard says, "I'm the king of rock and roll, not Elvis Presley." He has a reason for doing so, because he really did change the sound of the music. I look at rock and roll as being a style of rhythm and blues under the larger rubric rhythm and blues, but clearly representing new ideas, new innovations coming from the second generation of African-American rhythm and blues performers.
And what we're going to hear now is you actually interviewing Little Richard's drummer and him commenting on this, and then that kind of leads into a musical segment from a Little Richard song.
Absolutely.
Well, this is Portia Maltby interviewing Little Richard's drummer, Charles Connor, and then we'll hear a musical excerpt from the Little Richard musical track, Tutti Frutti, on Profiles.
Rock and roll is really rhythm and blues with a fast tempo. Now, rock and roll, Little Richard and I, we created or invented the rock and roll beat not in 1955, not in 1956, in 1950, about the beginning of 1954. Because during the rhythm and blues, you had like, it was both like a shuffle with a backbeat. But Little Richard wanted something different. He wanted something like with more energy, but he didn't know how to describe the notes. So Richard brought me down to the Greyhound, to the train station in Macon, Georgia in 1954. And he said, "Charles, listen to the choo-choo train style." And at first I didn't know what he was talking about, because I couldn't imagine a beat for a choo-choo train style. He said, "Do you understand what I'm talking about? You hear the choo-choo train when it's leaving the train station? And I told Richard, I said, "Well, you probably want 8 notes or 16 notes." And we went back to his house a couple of days later. We used to rehearse in the front room, live his living room in Macon, Georgia. And we came up with that beat. Richard was just like a Lucille, you know. Well, I was doing the same thing on my cymbal that he was doing on the piano, like my cymbal and my snare drum with a backbeat. Nobody had ever played that beat before, and we was the first one that came up with this 8 or 16 note rock and roll beat, choo-choo train style, because before that, drummers was only doing like a swing, or they were doing this, a backbeat with a shuffle with a backbeat. And even though in 53 and 54, Richard was doing shuffles and everything on the piano, but I would still use that choo-choo train style. He would do something like, instead of me doing the shuffle beat, I would do the
Little Richard performing Tutti Frutti, and before that we heard Little Richard's drummer, Charles Connor, speaking with Professor Portia Maltsby, who is our guest on Profiles. Professor Maltsby, how has the study of African-American music changed and evolved over the past 100 years?
I think it has evolved in terms of the approach to the study of the music, the research methodologies and analytical tools employed with the study of that tradition. For example, the early approaches were very descriptive. And from a scholarly point of view, the emphasis was placed on the musical sound itself. In other words, the elements of structure and technique. There is no contextualization of the music. And much of the information gathered came from primary source materials such as newspapers, manuscripts, personal letters, diaries, missionary reports, and other documents from organizations involved in the community life in some way. So the early writings had very little to do with the context for the creation of the music or the context that gave the music its special character. Those studies were primarily done by musicologists or individuals with that kind of some kind of musical background. Then later, a new approach was introduced, which was more ethnographic, which involved the understanding of the people and the music and the making of the music within the context of the social, cultural, and political environment. In essence, contextualizing the music-making process allowed scholars to look at a more culture-specific meaning that was a part of the of making music. Then the two approaches converged, the anthropological or the ethnographic research and the musicological. And essentially within that framework, the quantitative approach was used to interpret the qualitative data. And in the 21st century, we have definitely seen the use of a variety of approaches from many, many disciplines, such as cultural studies, you know, African-American studies, American studies, sociology, history. And today we benefit from this multidisciplinary perspective that really did not exist in the early studies of the music.
How has the white audience's reaction to new developments in African-American music changed over that same span of time, and how has it perhaps remained similar?
Well, African-American music originally existed on the margins of society. And over time, the music has slowly become integrated into the mainstream of society, but in very different ways. For example, early on, we'll just take the jazz bands, for example. In the 1930s and 40s, the swing became known as American, you know, form of music in terms of its popularity. White musicians emerged, but because of the social structure of society that separated the races, white artists received far more exposure over radio, eventually over television, than black artists. So the history of jazz then becomes somewhat obscured from the view of who's deciding who are the kings and queens of the music. So Benny Goodman becomes king of swing, Paul Whiteman becomes king of jazz, and where are the Duke Ellingtons? Where are the Count Basies? And so the way in which the music entered the mainstream had to do with the social climate of the time. And cover groups of white groups were promoted over black groups, and therefore the music became associated with those players. In the 1950s, and largely through the role of radio and in a growing teenage consumer group, the music was marketed slightly differently. Cover versions were preferred by pop radio stations over the original versions. Again, social policy dictated that kind of marketing process, where white artists were presenting the music to the mainstream and black artists hidden. But as black radio emerged as a force, you cannot segregate the airwaves. You can segregate people, but not the airwaves. And as black programming evolved, beginning in the late 40s and certainly by the 50s, 24-hour or at least 8-hour program stations of black music, whites began to hear this music. And through that process, discovered the original artist. And now there was demand for the original artist.
What happens to African-American music as it becomes absorbed by white musicians and into this mainstream audience that you're talking about?
Well, the music begins to change, to undergo certain changes. for the purpose of mainstream marketing, certain aesthetic changes are made. For example, in the 50s, in the late 50s, many black artists, when it was apparent that the demand was for the original artist, then the challenge then is how do we make this artist palatable to the mainstream taste beyond the teenagers, but so that parents would find it acceptable or as acceptable as possible. And the idea was through production, applying pop production techniques, strings, heavy strings, and orchestral kinds of arrangements to de-emphasize the blackness of the voice. So what begins to happen is that as the music becomes more and more integrated in society, the aesthetic changes and then new meanings are given, to which is why there's often confusion about what the music means, who it belongs to, what defines it as what, and who are the pioneering artists. It becomes confused. Hip-hop is a very good example of that. Now it is deemed to be American music. We hear it everywhere. But then where is the African-American identity? Slowly that's being made more and more invisible in terms of the heritage. Like jazz. Jazz is known by many as America's music. Where is the African component of the American?
Some people have argued that the Motown sound of the 1960s, which was hugely popular and widely credited to Motown founder Berry Gordy, was a kind of dilution of the black sound in popular music. And I think this is a perception that you've spoken to in some of your work. What created that perception, and is it valid?
I don't think it's a valid perception. I think the perception was created because the Motown sound was very different from the stereotypical notion of a black sound, which was more of a hard edge, more rhythm and blues oriented in terms of heavy combo. But I think the problem in interpreting Motown against the backdrop of the Southern sound is that it was not created within a Southern environment. Motown was created, that sound was created in a Northern environment, representative of a new teenage population whose experiences and sensibilities were very different from the teenagers growing up with what I would call with the Southern experience. Then there's another factor. Berry Gordy, who helped produce the Motown sound, had a preference for jazz and for certain kind, more softer crooning type singers. He liked Nat King Cole. In fact, he was a singer, Berry Gordy, and he emulated the Nat King Cole sound, which is why he liked Diana Ross. He loved Diana Washington, you know, Etta Fitzgerald, those kinds of singers. At the same time, in creating a sound, Berry Gordy engaged musicians from the jazz clubs. You know, they were trained musicians, and they were the ones that really created what became known as the Motown sound, and what made that sound very different from your Southern R&B sound or any other R&B sound of that time was actually the bass patterns and bass work of James Jamerson, the bass player. And that can truly be illustrated in many of the recordings of the 64, 65, 66, and especially in one that I would like to illustrate.
Well, you've brought this along for us to listen to now, and this is recorded in 1964, and you've said that we should pay special attention to the bass line here. This is Mary Wells and My Guy. That was the rhythm track from Mary Wells' 1964 recording of My Guy. And Professor Maltzby, I believe you kind of said that bass line by James Jamerson there is almost like electric bebop in a way.
Yeah, it's not electric. Acoustic. He was playing acoustic bass.
Acoustic bass mm-hmm. on that track. Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of Motown, your colleague Charles Sykes developed and now teaches the first college credit class on the label and its music. And you developed and taught the first college credit class about hip-hop. Can you talk a little bit about the origins of those two classes and your and Charles Sykes' experiences in teaching them?
Well, I was interested in developing a course on hip-hop to help students understand the relevance of that music within the context of the larger African-American culture, in particular inner-city culture. At the time I developed the course, the music was very controversial. And I felt that it was being unfairly critiqued and critiqued without a total understanding of the music in its original form versus the music when it has now become available for mainstream. Same issue again, from the margins into the mainstream and the changes that take place and the way the music is marketed and its reception and how it was done in a fashion that distorted the evolution and significance of the music within African American culture. So I wanted to create a course to bring attention to the early history and provide a different perspective than what we were getting via the media, et cetera.
Have you had any sort of conscious reception to that in terms of like, why are you teaching a class on rap music or anything like that? I'm just thinking of people initially when jazz came into the universities, it always seems as if when African American music, popular music especially, comes in the academy, at first there's an initial resistance to it. There's almost a questioning of its validity as a scholarly topic.
I think you're absolutely correct on that, and that's always been the case. I think largely because of the focus of music schools on Western traditions and the notions that popular music is the making of the music industry, that there is little validity, it's faddish, it's here for a minute and gone. And that was partially what fed my interest in wanting to bring some academic validity to the popular tradition at large, was to show that there is significance to this music. There's meaning beyond its marketing and its production as an economic commodity.
How does rap and hip hop connect with what has come before in African American music, and in what ways is maybe it different from what's come before in African American music?
Hip hop is a continuum of the African American tradition. It is not apart from earlier traditions. In fact, much of it is grounded in storytelling and in early forms that of oral traditions put to music. In terms of its rhythmic focus, it is grounded in an earlier tradition. The sampling comes from music of earlier times. So for me, hip-hop is a collage of sounds that brings together the past and the present with innovation.
Well, I know that also there are certain things in rap music. You hear political messages in rap from groups like Public Enemy, and that's certainly a continuance of something that had already emerged in African-American popular music that maybe in earlier music was more coded and became more overt in the 1950s and 1960s. Can you talk about how politics came to play a role in the soul and funk music of the 1960s and 1970s?
Yeah, political messages in black popular music became prevalent beginning in the 1960s with the whole Black Power movement and the evolution of soul as a byproduct of that movement. And the idea was to help disseminate the ideology of Black Power, which also extended to the identification with an African heritage and identity. That ideology carried over into the 70s with the evolution of funk, which comes from the soul movement. By the mid-70s, soul music had begun to decline as the most popular form of black expression, and funk had emerged, overlapping the soul movement. And George Clinton was successful in bringing together the ideology of soul and the social, the commentary about the 70s, but in a way that it was not didactic. He was able to use comedy and use mythical figures to help black people understand their empowerment. So his idea was to create a music that had a political message and at the same time was fun, was danceable. Funk was a dance-oriented music. And his music combined the two with the understanding what he wanted to do was put black people in positions where he said they were not supposed to be during the decade of the 70s. And that is really illustrated in a number of his songs. He has them underwater, you know, he has them in space, and he has them in the White House.
Well, we're going to hear one now from George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic. This is Chocolate City on Profiles.
Oh, what's happening, CC? They still call it the White House, but that's a temporary condition, too. Can you dig it, CC? To each his reach, and if I don't cop, it ain't mine to have. But I'll be reaching for you, 'cause I love you, CC. Right on. There's a lot of chocolate cities around. We've got Newark, we've got Gary. Somebody told me we got L.A. And we're working on Atlanta. But you're the capital
city.
Parliament Funkadelic's Chocolate City. I'm David Brent Johnson, and our guest on Profiles is Indiana University professor and ethnomusicologist Portia Maltsby. Professor Maltsby, how do you yourself remember encountering and reacting to this music, to the soul music of the 60s and 70s, and the political and social messages that were kind of contained within it when it was coming out? I mean, what was your experience hearing this music and the experience of your friends hearing it when it was coming out?
I found the music exciting, and so did my friends. It represented another kind of energy, a new level of energy that was very consistent with the spirit of the times. I grew up in the segregated South and was a part of the early demonstrations towards change. And this music was a galvanizing force. I mean, it was a message that, wow, yes, we really can do this. It was a message of empowerment and to which we are related. And shortly after, I remember in 1968 when Martin Luther King was killed and, you know, all the riots and again, this notion about, hey, we can take charge of ourselves. We can do. And the music sent that message to us, the energy in the music, the aesthetic of the sound, just the whole excitement, the emotionalism involved was very inspiring.
Is that one of the things that sort of inspired you ultimately to become you became the founding director of the IU Soul Review, which is a musical ensemble that's dedicated to presenting African-American popular music. Can you talk about how and when that came about and what the mission of the group has ended up becoming over the years?
Well, it actually was a concept of a vice chancellor at the time, Herman Hudson. And he witnessed a lot of talent shows sponsored by students and recognized all of the talent. And he said that he really wanted to have some kind of formal instruction to channel and further develop this talent. Once Dr. Hudson became aware of my involvement as a performer of popular music, he aggressively pursued me to take a job at Indiana University with forming an ensemble for course credit as being one of my assignments. So it really was a concept that began with him. I was very much influenced by James Brown and the whole James Brown Review, and I evolved in a concept similar to that review. And I named the group the IU Soul Review because it was going to be a big stage show of singers and dancers and horn players and poets, etc. And that's how that evolved. And largely the mission was to disseminate the music within an academic framework to bring about a greater cultural awareness of the significance of the music.
When did you start the IU Soul Review?
In 1971.
And it's still going strong today?
And we're the only credit-bearing popular music ensemble in the country.
Do you play just here at IU, or do you go out and play other places and universities? And
well, the ensemble always toured. We've been, frankly, all over the U.S., the East Coast, West Coast. We had regular Southern tours when I was director. We played on the East Coast, Rhode Island, and they played in New York. And we've been to the Midwest, the West. We've performed in Iowa. So the ensemble performs all over the country.
What are some of the trends and styles in African-American popular music over the past 10 years, and where might you see it going in the future?
Hip-hop has dominated the tradition, I would say, over the past 10 years, with, however, new forms that brings about a balance to the tradition. And I would say neo-soul is perhaps the more recent one, which I look at as being a fusion of elements from jazz and soul and R&B. Unlike hip-hop, which is really electronically produced, much of neo-soul is produced by live instruments and live performers.
And you've brought along something that's from one of your favorite neo-soul performers. Can you talk a little bit about this track by Angie Stone?
The song is called No More Rain, and I like that track a lot because Angela Stone's view was to move back to the organic sound of soul. And what she does is samples well-known songs, in this case, Neither One of Us by Gladys Knight. But what's unique about what she does is she creates her own lyrics and she takes it to another level. But it connects with the past and that organic sound of soul through the sampling of the tracks. What I think is also interesting about most of the neo-soul artists is that they compose their own music, they play instruments, and it's very reminiscent of that kind of spirit, but in a contemporary way of the 1960s. And I think this song very much illustrates that.
That was Angie Stone and No More Rain. This is David Brent Johnson, and Professor Portia Maltzby is our guest on Profiles. Professor Maltzby, you're also amongst your many duties as a scholar and an author and a musician, and you have a new anthology out that you've co-edited that's an introduction to African-American music, and it's about 650 pages long, which it's pretty comprehensive, but it's a really wonderful kind of overarching book that attempts to give people an acquaintance with this vast subject. You're also the director of the Archives of African-American Music and Culture at Indiana University. Can you tell us a bit about some of the unusual and interesting items that you have in the archives?
The Archives of African-American Music and Culture specializes in the collection of materials of the post-World War II era. In my own research, I discovered that there were very few materials on popular music, gospel music, and like I say, post-World War II. And that's what I decided that we needed to fill that void. I think we had some unique collections we have are the radio shows of the Johnny Otis group out of California. We have his television shows. We have the entire series called Special Edition, and that represents the popular music of the 1960s and primarily 1970s and 80s. And it's a show that consists of narration, music, and interviews with the artists. It's wonderful material. And we have all of the research material related to each of those shows. So, for example, Earth, Wind, and Fire, there are two or three shows on Earth, Wind, and Fire at different points. And we have all of the interviews with the artists used to produce those shows. Another collection, of course, that we have is the Black Radio collection of materials that were used in the production of Telling It Like It Was. Very extensive. That production was done by Jackie Webb at Smithsonian Radio. So we have all of those interviews and tapes, just wonderful. We are amassing a representative amount of sheet music of the gospel tradition and interviews with artists. In October, on October the 21st, we're hosting a conference on techno with the goal of documenting the African-American origins of techno music, and the focus will be on Detroit techno.
Wow, that would be very interesting. Well, you know, I guess my last question would be, how do you, for you, what have been some of the difficulties and maybe some of the pleasures of sort of translating and transporting the entire experience of African-American musical culture into the academy? It's a culture that didn't emerge in the academy. It emerged in all these different places that you talked about at the beginning of the program, the churches, clubs, streets, everything. And now it's becoming a part of, over the last 40 years, become a part of American academic life as well. How does it, it's kind of joined the academic mainstream, mm-hmm. as it were. And what are some of the difficulties and the pleasures that you've encountered in helping to carry out this immense task?
I didn't encounter many difficulties, and I think primarily because the music as a course, as a curriculum, as a part of the curriculum, was introduced through the Department of African American Studies. I think the scenario would have been very different had the popular tradition been introduced through schools of music. Now, what I must admit is that when I was recruited to Indiana University, largely on the David Baker's recommendation, I was to assist him in developing the curriculum, or to share the curriculum that he was developing in black music as a part of the jazz studies program in music. So it was within that context of jazz studies that popular music could evolve and joined with Afro-American studies. So I think here at Indiana University, there were less difficulties than might have been the case at another institution during that particular era in the 1970s and early 1970s. Now, it's become acceptable for anyone to introduce any form of popular music in the curriculum, even in schools of music. It's much easier today. Now, whether or not it's looked upon favorably is another issue among some of the faculty members, but that's not so much the issue as the courses are now available and students from all over, all disciplines, enroll in those courses.
Well, Professor Maltzby, thanks so much for joining us on Profiles. This is David Brent Johnson, and you've been listening to ethnomusicologist and Indiana University Professor Portia Maltzby on Profiles.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in July of 2006. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. The recording engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily Blacklin McCord, research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. In addition, this and other Profiles programs can be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening.